Great. Well, welcome, everyone. I want to thank you for joining us for this national telebriefing, an update on Fukushima 3 years on. We're doing this tonight to update the American public on the status of the Fukushima nuclear accidents. I'm Tim Judson, the Executive Director for the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, which is hosting the briefing. We're really pleased that so many of you could be here tonight. This is the first in a series of quarterly briefings we'll be hosting to provide the people in the U.S. and around the world with in-depth information and access to technical experts and leaders on the most urgent issues relating to nuclear power, sustainable energy, radioactive waste, and the public health risks of radiation. These briefings are all open to the public for anyone to attend, and while we primarily invite people to attend them through our email list of supporters and our followers on social media, we really encourage you to spread the word to anyone you think would be interested in the topics our briefings cover. For those of you not familiar with NIRS, we're the primary national information and resource center for the anti-nuclear and safe energy movement in the U.S. For 35 years, we've worked to end the use of nuclear power in the United States and worked for technically sound, environmentally just, and publicly acceptable solutions for radioactive waste. We provide support to grassroots activists and local campaigns, and we serve as a watchdog in Washington, D.C., leading national campaigns on policy issues such as the Mobile Chernobyl bill and taxpayer subsidies to build new nuclear reactors. But to be successful, we also need your support, both in terms of taking action on the issues and, just as importantly, in whatever financial support you can provide for our work. If you feel NIRS's work is important, please consider supporting us financially. You can make a donation online at our website or send one in the email. Send one in the mail. We can find our address on our website as well, which is www.nirs.org. The reason that we're starting these briefings now is it's more important really now than ever for people in the United States to be informed and involved in nuclear issues. As we enter the fourth year of the Fukushima nuclear accidents, we felt that it's really the most important place for us to start in hosting these briefings. We hope tonight's presentations will give you the information you need to sort through conflicting and too often inaccurate information about what is happening at Fukushima and to know what you can do about it. For those of us in the U.S., we need to know what needs to be done in Japan to get the Fukushima disaster under control, certainly. But it is also our job to make sure the same thing does not happen here, that the world does not experience another Fukushima, Chernobyl, or Three Mile Island nuclear disaster. The good news is we really have an opportunity to change nuclear energy and radioactive waste policy in the U.S. now to a degree that we may never have had before. Last year, more nuclear power plants were closed than in any single year in U.S. history. A total of 5 reactors in 4 states were permanently shut down, and another 8 new reactors were canceled. Advances in sustainable energy solutions and falling electricity prices have exposed the fundamentally bad economics of nuclear power, and potentially dozens more reactors could shut down in the coming years, but only if the American public is engaged and make sure that happens. NIRS is there working on that, supporting grassroots campaigns around the country and opposing the industry's attempts to secure new bailouts for their oldest, most uncompetitive reactors. But the industry is also trying to save itself by rolling back safety regulations, including safety standards and requirements brought to light by the accidents at Fukushima, which really brings us to tonight's presentation, an update on Fukushima 3 years on. We have tonight 3 experts and leaders who have been on the front lines watchdogging the situation at Fukushima since the accident started. So I'm just going to go through and give some introductions now. As Mary indicated before, we're going to hold questions and answers until after the presentations are complete. And because of the broad attendance tonight and the difficulty in managing an active Q&A session, we're taking questions that were submitted to us by email, and we'll be posing those questions to the presenters on your behalf. If you do have questions in the course of the event, you can also email us. You can actually email me at timj@nirs.org. And if we have time, we'll be able to get to those questions. But right now, I'll introduce the presenters, and we'll proceed with the presentation. So first, we're going to hear from Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates. Arnie is one of the foremost technical experts on nuclear power in the United States. He gained this expertise working for decades as an engineer, executive, and consultant in the nuclear industry. And since founding Fairwinds, he's provided that knowledge and insights to policymakers and environmental groups concerned about nuclear safety. He's provided some of the clearest and most valuable analysis of the events at Fukushima for people in the U.S. Through video presentations on the Fairwinds website, through media interviews and publications. He's also offered critical testimony in some of the most important nuclear safety issues going on in the U.S., including the regulatory proceeding that ultimately led to the closure of the San Onofre nuclear generating station in California last year. So we welcome Arnie. Next, we'll also hear from Eileen Miyoko-Smith, who's the director of the organization Green Action in Japan. Eileen has been a tireless activist in Japan on nuclear issues for decades. One of her most significant contributions was her work opposing the use of plutonium-laced mixed oxide fuel, or MOX, in Japan, which delayed widespread use of MOX and prevented a potentially even worse disaster at Fukushima. But probably one of the most notable examples of Eileen's leadership is her courage in returning to Japan after the accident started. Many people who know Eileen's work still don't know that she was actually in the U.S. visiting family when the earthquake struck, and it's a sign of her commitment to the people of Japan and the victims of the accident that she went back while others were fleeing the country. So welcome, Eileen. Lastly, we're going to hear from Diane DiRigo. Diane is the director of the Radioactive Waste Project at NIRS. She's been with NIRS for over 25 years and has been a leader in radioactive waste issues in the U.S. And has been involved in stopping over three dozen radioactive waste sites, radioactive waste dumps in the U.S. and has provided technical analysis, and support to the grassroots on issues of radiation standards, radioactive waste, and even the recycling of radioactive materials here in the U.S. So we'll look forward to Diane's presentation on the issues of radiation and health effects from the Fukushima accident. So with that, I'd want to go ahead and get started, and we'll go to Arnie. So Arnie, welcome.
Hi, thank you, Tim, and thank you, NIRS, for sponsoring this, and thank you everyone who's out there listening. I appreciate it. My topic tonight is a little bit of an update on what is going on the Fukushima site technically, mechanically, and I'll get right into it. The first thing is the what's going on with the water. I'm sure that's everybody's primary concern. And there's hundreds and hundreds of tanks on the site that are frequently leaking and releasing water into the ground. And those tanks are necessary because groundwater continues to leak into these buildings. But that's not the major source of the water that's getting out of the plant and into the Pacific Ocean. The big source of the leak is the buildings themselves. The nuclear reactor cores have melted through the nuclear reactor and are lying in the foundation somewhere. And that means that the foundation is leaking groundwater in amongst the nuclear fuel. And so it really doesn't matter whether or not that fuel melted through the containment, because Mother Earth is coming to the fuel. The nuclear fuel is in direct contact with groundwater. Now, the groundwater issues on site then are exacerbated by the tanks, but the real issue is the buildings are leaking like sieves. Just 3 days ago, TEPCO released a report that shows that the groundwater, the contaminated groundwater in the wells, is rising and lowering with the tide. Now, what that means is that there are no barriers between the groundwater and the ocean, and so we're seeing a tidal influence on the groundwater. Tokyo Electric is planning to put in an ice wall. That's still 2 years away. And basically, over the 3 years so far and the 2 years coming up, a huge radioactive lake will form underneath these buildings, and they'll bleed into the Pacific Ocean for 100 years. The isotopes are cesium, which everybody talks about, but also huge amounts of strontium-90. That's a separate concern for leukemias in the long haul. So this is a problem, the water on the site, that's not going to go away. It's different than what happened at Chernobyl, because Chernobyl, the nuclear core never came in contact with groundwater. There was a huge meltdown, but it melted into dry land and dry space in the power plant. Whereas at Fukushima, the groundwater is in direct contact with the nuclear core. And that's also going to feed into the second issue here, which is the physical condition of the structures on the site. Unlike Chernobyl, we've got structures where we don't know where the nuclear core is, but we do know that it's wet and in contact with groundwater. So fragments of the nuclear core are spreading out throughout the building and also leaking into the groundwater. Now, everybody's been focused on the Unit 4 spent fuel pool, and that certainly was top priority, but it's also the easiest problem on the site to tackle. And I think you'll recall just how easy, how difficult that problem really was and will continue to be. The spent fuel pool cleanup has been extraordinarily slow. Normally, if this was a normal power reactor, they could have moved the 1,500 fuel bundles in about 2 months. But it's going to take Tokyo Electric over a year and a half to do it, if, in fact, they can do it at all. You know, problems are already being encountered in Unit 4. And let me remind everybody that Unit 4 is the easy problem. So I'm afraid that after the fuel is removed from Unit 4, the Japanese and Tokyo Electric may dismantle Unit 4 and as basically a show that the reactor can be decommissioned. That's basically a costly diversion of money and resources. But I am afraid that the Tokyo Electric and the Japanese will consider knocking that building down to show the Japanese that one out of four reactors are eliminated. 99% of the radiation is in the other three, and really the efforts of Tokyo Electric and the Japanese government would be better spent tackling Units 1, 2, and 3 after the fuel is removed from Unit 4. Unit 3 is horrible. The roof has collapsed. The radiation levels inside are so high that people can get in for 5 or 10 minutes before they exceed their quarterly exposures. And so basically, no one knows how to decontaminate Unit 3 especially, but likely the other two as well. It'll have to be done robotically, and many engineering organizations estimate that it's going to take more than 50 years to do. So think about that. That means that someone getting out of college now is going to be retired and will still have the Fukushima nuclear plant standing on the banks of the Pacific. That's a long time, and possibly as long as 100 years. I think on this issue of what's going on site, we all have to ask the question, where the heck are the nuclear cores? And the answer is nobody knows, and it'll be years until we can determine exactly the extent of the spread of that nuclear material into the basement and into the groundwater. Last piece of this issue on site is the cost estimates. I've heard people say, oh, it's going to cost $15 billion to decommission the site. That's baloney. A good nuclear plant that hasn't had a meltdown is over $1 billion. So we've got four power plants that have had meltdowns. It might be $15 billion each, or $60 or $70 billion to do the entire site. TEPCO and the Japanese government don't want to admit that. The third issue is the issue of off-site exposures, cancers. I'm appalled at what the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is doing. They're basically whitewashing all the off-site exposures. They have absolutely ignored the releases of noble gases. Noble gases are things like xenon and krypton. They're similar to the gases in a fluorescent bulb, but these are radioactive. And after the accident, the releases of noble gases were three times higher than they were at Chernobyl. those numbers are completely ignored by the IAEA, TEPCO, and the Japanese government. The next item on that, though, is that we have seen a dramatic increase in thyroid cancers already. I'm sure we'll talk about that later in the presentation. But that's another indication of a huge iodine release. My biggest concern is something called hot particles. We have found small, microscopic particles as far away as 300 miles in vacuum cleaner bags. People in Japan are sending us their vacuum cleaner bags, and we found small microscopic particles that are as radioactive as nuclear fuel. What that would mean is instead of that being in a vacuum cleaner bag, if that's in someone's lung, the certainty of death is 100% from cancer at some point in their life. Now, no one is tracking these hot particles. However, the vacuum cleaner bags are telling a story of the deposition of these hot particles throughout Japan, and in fact, as far as 400 kilometers, 300 miles away from the reactor. And the last piece is that the net effect here is that there's a gross distortion of the health statistics in Japan. This is being exacerbated because of the state secrets law that the Japanese have passed. But in general, up and down the chain of command, doctors and medical professionals and epidemiologists are not being truthful with the Japanese people as far as what their off-site exposure likely will be. I'm on record as saying somewhere between 100,000 and a million cancers as a result of this, and I still stand by that. The IAEA says 100, so there's a big difference between my 100,000 and the IAEA's 100 cancers here. And the last issue is, what is the root cause of this accident? It was not an act of God. It was an act of greed. The American company General Electric, when it built these plants in 1966 and 1970, made design decisions knowing full well that if the plant had been hit by a historical tsunami, it would have been inundated. The reason the plant is as low as it is and as close to the water is so General Electric could save money. And I'm certainly convinced, too, that Tokyo Electric is incompetent, and the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and the Japanese government have both failed to face the true magnitude of the problem. And, you know, in order to solve a problem, you have to admit you have a problem. And the Abe regime and IAEA are desperately trying to start nuclear power plants back up. It's hard to start nuclear power plants up when the people of Japan are facing a $500 billion cleanup bill and are facing as much as a million cancers as a result. But that information is not being provided to the Japanese people in an accurate and timely way. So the last piece of this is, how do we get out of this mess? First, we have to get rid of Tokyo Electric and have the Japanese government admit to their people the true magnitude of the problem. Right now, the Japanese government is using Tokyo Electric as a scapegoat, and it's a very comfortable relationship because as long as TEPCO can keep screwing up, the Japanese government has someone else to blame and can underestimate the cleanup costs because they've convinced the Japanese people it's coming out of the pockets of the ratepayers. In fact, they're all on the hook for $500 billion. What we really need is an open and transparent process in Japan involving citizens and scientists that aren't linked to the nuclear industry. Okay, I'm going to pass it on now. Thank you again to Niers.
Great. Thanks so much, Arnie. That was terrific. So now we'll move on to Eileen's presentation. Eileen, welcome.
Thank you. I'm speaking from Kyoto, Japan. Right now, all the nuclear power plants in Japan are shut. But as Arnie mentioned, there's a big rush attempt to restart, and we're fighting against that. In other words, we're trying to stop a second Fukushima disaster. And Arnie just mentioned that the Fukushima accident was not an act of God, it was an act of greed, and that's absolutely correct, and that's really important to note. The Japanese Diet commissioned an investigation that's really the only really good investigation that's been done, and that's the Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Committee, and they definitely said that the accident was man-made. In other words, it's not a natural disaster. Unfortunately, they did not name names, and to this date, not a single person has been criminally charged for causing the accident, and yet they are people that made that decision that actually led to the accident and is causing tremendous suffering. And one of the, for example, the decision to build the plant there in Fukushima Daiichi site, they already knew that groundwater is there. Every day, this groundwater going underneath the plant did not start on March 11th. Every day, 400 tons of groundwater was going under the plant, and they were pumping it up. And they knew that. They knew that they had built it there, and they went ahead and did it. The other point that's really important to note is that the tsunami itself, 3 years ago, killed 15,884 people, and over 8,000 are injured and still missing. And it's very important to know that the Japanese government chose a tsunami underestimate. In other words, they said it's okay to build all around, a tsunami won't arrive. They chose the estimate of the Japanese Society of Civil Engineers, which is riddled with nuclear industry people. They chose that estimate over the estimate of an expert association on earthquakes and tsunamis. And that association, after the accident, the head of it pointed out that 78% of the deaths of the tsunami were caused in that band of land that was underestimated because of the standard. And all those people didn't think a tsunami would arrive. And the people where they knew they were in a tsunami zone were saved much more because they were already, you know, aware that they could be hit by a tsunami. So we're talking about, you know, decisions by people that caused deaths with the Fukushima Daiichi accident, you know, future health problems and deaths, and also even with the tsunami. And I want to go on and talk about the current situation with the Fukushima accident and evacuation. There's still 150,000 people evacuated from the contaminated area in Fukushima. And the official figure is 135,546. Two-thirds of these people are in other areas of the prefecture of Fukushima, which is less contaminated, and a third are scattered around Japan. There's so many also people that have decided to evacuate even though there wasn't official evacuation. So that means that they don't get the financial, you know, various benefits that you get if you were under official evacuation. In other words, you did it because you wanted to. But that's tremendously unfair. There are lawsuits going on all over Japan by people, evacuees, people who voluntarily evacuated, and lawsuit after lawsuit is being turned down. The plaintiffs' demands are being turned down, and they're losing. And it's because the courts say you can't prove that Fukushima caused your problems. As you know, suddenly, you know, you have the standard for how many, what people can be exposed to the radiation before the accident, and suddenly they upped it 20 times to 20 millisieverts a year for people who live in the contaminated area, which is tremendously unfair. It's a human rights issue because everybody else's standard is much stricter. And particularly for children, because children are much more vulnerable to radiation, also females more than males. And I've been to countless meetings. You know, the Japanese people aren't silent. You don't hear that much because it's all in Japanese language and doesn't get conveyed abroad. But their busloads of parents come down to Tokyo, to the legislator offices, and meet with government officials and pound the table, demanding that the children have a right to evacuate. In other words, they could be supported by the government and evacuated. And the government continues to say, no, 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 we'll decontaminate your area. And then the parents demand again, look, our kids are you know, running around lower than the 1 meter, and they're being exposed even more than 20, you know, the 20 millisievert standard. And yet the government keeps saying decontaminate. And so there's been this big effort to decontaminate all over Fukushima, and it's not working very well. But right now there are piles and piles of contaminated dirt that's topsoil that's been taken off. There's no place to take it, so it's piled up along the roads. It's piled up in the fields. It's buried in family gardens. And people, for example, living in Fukushima, they, you know, they're carrying these radiation monitors all around, and like the living room is high right now, let's go to this other room, and you can't have your children go outside and play, etc. So that's sort of life in Fukushima, or you decide just to ignore it. You know, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just not going to think about it. And it's really tearing people apart because, you know, those who are concerned about radiation are criticized. So essentially the evacuees have been holding their breath, and only last December did the government announce that some areas won't ever be able to return. But now there's a big effort to get people back. There have been 12 municipalities that were officially evacuated. Now six are to be returned over the next 2 years. That's 30,000 people that are faced with, you can go back now. If you don't go back, that's your choice. We're not going to help you. And then the other remaining six communities, too, there's deliberation and repatriation, including Itate, which is heavily, heavily contaminated. A portion of that is supposed to be repatriated. And the thing is, you get this is a scheme. You get like $9,000 if you go back, and you don't get that money if you don't. And so that's the problem that people are facing. And we invite evacuees. There are lots of people that are self-evacuated, like even in our area in Kyoto. And one woman said the other day that you're all living March 10th. We're living March after March 11th. This is the reality. You look at a flower and you think, can I pick it up? I can't. And you look around and, you know, it's just life is different. And she's basically warning us because in the Kyoto-Osaka area, we're very close to the largest concentration of nuclear power plants practically in the world. And that's supposed to be the next dangerous place next to Hamaoka, which is the most dangerous earthquake-wise. So we're trying to stop restart of those areas. The citizen fight for justice has been tremendous. And a year and a half ago, a wonderful law was passed. It's the victim relief law for the Fukushima accident. It was passed by every single member in the Diet, the Parliament of Japan. Not a single person, legislator, opposed it. And yet the implementation is not being done. In other words, the law which said, all evacuees should be treated equally. It should not be just the immediate area right around the plant. 1 millisievert, the original standard should be the standard. And yet because there isn't a budget, the appropriations, the law is not being implemented, and that is a big problem. Citizens have gotten the UN here. The UN Human Rights Rapporteur issued a very good statement last May saying that you had to work towards 1 millisievert, the Japanese government, but the Japanese government has ignored that. And right now there's a big effort to educate the Japanese public about radiation, quote-unquote, educate. And the Reconstruction Agency is working to get Fukushima and that disaster area back to normal. And $1 billion is being spent on this. And the education problem is very insidious because the government says if the government tells people radiation is safe, then people feel suspect. But what they're doing is they're trying to train local Fukushima people to be the spokespeople. And you get around in circles and you discuss. It's not like a lecture form. And the media and a lot of citizens of Fukushima are very angry about this because they're saying, you know, are you telling us to just grin and bear it? And are you telling us that we're stupid if we worry about radiation? But that's the way people are being treated. And this program is very extensive so that people will go back to their areas. The health study, which Arnie mentioned, also is a huge problem. It's a terrible health study that's in place right now by the government authorities. It's completely limited and is checking thyroid, but not other health problems that could occur. There isn't a proper control case so that, and it's basically designed sort of to not find anything. And this study is so terrible in its design, and it's just written in Japanese, and so it doesn't get an international exposure. We translated it into English, but the Japanese government is still refusing to get a lot of this information into English so that it can be critiqued by the international community. Going in a couple more minutes here to some of the things Arnie mentioned, the Fukushima site and all the radioactive discharges into the ocean. We recently submitted a petition, thanks NIRS for supporting this. 140 citizens from 140 nations wrote in and signed this petition demanding that the government assure that releases do not go into the ocean. And we submitted that final petition, people from A to Z, Afghanistan to Zimbabwe, signed this petition. Just this last week, we have discovered that the radiation leaks are happening at another well. It had spiked back in October. The government must have known it, but didn't report it. And the problem is the Nuclear Regulation Authority is working to restart nuclear power most of the time and not working on Fukushima disaster site. We counted, they said they don't have a count on how much time they spend on both. So we counted, and the Nuclear Regulation Authority commissioners spent only 67 hours on Fukushima site, including the radioactive discharges in the ocean, since last July, but 457 hours on restart of nuclear power. And that's what we're trying to change, have them concentrate on the Fukushima site. Finally, reaching out to the international community, I want to say that what we need support from is that the international community demand that Japan, the Japanese government, open up the investigation to international experts and the international community, both the Fukushima disaster site itself, also the health study, also environmental studies. For example, Dr. Tim Musso is researching birds and finding out, you know, that there are effects on the natural environment, and yet researchers are not supported in Japan to do international work. We need that opening up of the international community. So this is a wonderful opportunity to talk about it because we're fighting right and left here in Japan, and we need all the support we can get. So thank you very much.
All right, thanks so much, Eileen. Really appreciate that. So we'll move on to Diane's presentation. Diane DiRico, the director of the Radioactive Waste Project at NIRS.
Hi. I wanted to address the issue of radiation and monitoring and continue to struggle with not really having the answers that all of us want. There's no safe level of ionizing radioactivity, so it's obviously best to avoid or prevent exposure. But it's pretty hard to do when you can't see, smell, taste, feel, or otherwise sense it. It requires radiation detection instruments, laboratories, sampling, reporting. It can involve calculation of radiation levels and doses and risks, and it's often layered with Don't worry, it's below somebody's accepted numbers. So the thing that we know from biology, from ecology, is that radioactive elements move throughout our environment, through the biological and the physical systems, like all other elements. They're not going to stay isolated. That violates the rule of entropy, the law of entropy. So monitoring one medium, like water, sediment, air, milk, fish, meat, one day, one time, one location is not adequate to tell the whole story. What's being monitored for? Alpha, beta, gamma, or the specific types of radionuclides that are giving off the alpha, beta, and gamma. It's expensive to do it well and to do it continually. In what media should it be, or in what media is it monitored? As I was saying, soil, water, air, food. Government reporting has been at different intervals and different times. The government also is relying on the generators of the radioactivity to provide the information. The government and the industry are the ones that have the resources to and the supposed cachet with the some of the public to be the experts, when in fact they're clearly conflicted and it's not in their self-interest to report honestly what's going on. In any case, they're the ones that have the resources to do monitoring. So over time, and it started even back around Three Mile Island in 1979, that members of the public, the population, have moved to do their own independent and now crowdsourced monitoring. We don't have real expensive equipment, but it's something, so that if there are very high levels or at least higher levels than in the range of background, that they might be able to be detected. So in Japan, right after the accident, we had TEPCO and the Nuclear Regulatory Authority telling us what they chose to tell us, and then independent monitoring began. People are getting detectors, coordinating their readings. As I said, after the Three Mile Island accident, Three Mile Island Alert started doing its own monitoring. When Seabrook was being built in the United States, C-10, the citizens within a 10-mile radius, were able to get some government support, which I don't believe they still have, but they did get government support in the early years to invest in monitors and do routine monitoring and reporting on their own. Groups in California, Arizona, Japan is where SafeCast has started up, but it is international. So people are getting their own detectors and reporting in. We have to be careful because different detectors have different sensitivities, and it's sometimes difficult to compare readings one to the other, but the efforts are making large strides. At the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, NIRS had compiled, and it's on our website, a list of all of the places. We've got a list of, we've got charts of links to places that are doing monitoring, and it's of any monitoring that we could that's being reported that we could find. So it lists these public crowdsource types, these local groups, international groups. It's split into U.S. and international, including Japan, and we welcome any updates, corrections to that listing. Then there are independent scientists, like at Woods Hole, who would like to have more government funding than they do. They would like to have whatever funding they can, and now they've started crowdsourcing to do monitoring. And it's some of the monitoring that's been done that answers more questions that we have than I've heard elsewhere. Woods Hole team took a boat to Fukushima and monitored and mapped their monitoring in relation to the currents that go across the Pacific. They looked at I believe they also took some fish samples and monitored for biota. So they made a distinction between the fish that are bottom feeders in the area where there's a lot of sediment that's not flushing through, and then larger fish that move across the ocean, and the kinds of radionuclides that might get into the fish's body and then get out. Where does it concentrate? Where does it flow through? So there are different radionuclides that concentrate in different parts of fishes' bodies and our bodies. And so there's some of that reported on the Woods Hole website, and if that's not on our website, I'll be putting that up, but that's also it's interesting information, and I hope that there could be more of that. There are also universities that are doing monitoring. University of California, Berkeley, has been doing reporting and coming out with, showing in some cases spikes of radioactivity in milk or in other substances that it is measuring. They don't necessarily attribute it to Fukushima, and it's very difficult sometimes to do so. But there is a way, if you look at the ratio of cesium-137 to 134, that you can attribute the shorter lasting, the 134, which is the two-year half-life, is more likely to be from Fukushima than from, say, older sources, bomb testing, and so forth. So radioactivity is definitely moving still into the ocean, as was mentioned by the two previous speakers, and inevitably, probably a lot more of it is going to be released, because how long the tanks have filled up, the tanks have been refilled, they've leaked, how many tanks can be built, how much water can be stored for how long. We're talking about some radioactivity that lasts thousands of years. And do we really think that they're going to hold water for that long, or what kind of processing will go on to really protect the world from this radioactivity? I wanted to also mention the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's RadNet network, which started back during bomb testing even, and has lived on through various permutations. It's the network that the Environmental Protection Agency points to show that it is doing monitoring, and in fact, there are many, many problems with this. First of all, it's not very usable. It's very difficult to fathom it, to go in and find, but you can go and look at, there's maybe 150 or so different locations where monitors exist around the United States, and they monitor for milk, water, precipitation, air, various, and they do it for specific radionuclides like cesium and iodine. And these are reported, but the reporting comes months after the sample is taken. So it's of absolutely no use as far as protection or preventing the eating of contaminated, drinking of contaminated milk or so forth. It's not real time. And there was a problem when the accident started 3 years ago, that Environmental Protection Agency put out more monitors, but then made the decision not to actually deploy them, not to use them. So at the place where the plume of radioactivity was expected to blow through between San Francisco and L.A., there were no monitors that were functioning during the early months. And the opportunity to use new detectors was not taken. They had detectors that they could have used, and they did not turn them on. So there's some real trouble with the EPA and what they've been doing, which, as I said earlier, led to people doing their own monitoring. I wanted to mention one more thing that the EPA did, which was to give bad advice to the Japanese about allowable contamination levels. The U.S. EPA has a risk range that they believe is okay for pollutants, carcinogens, and the risk range is that 1 in 1 million people, or if they can't protect to that level, then as high of a risk as 1 in 10,000 people can get cancer from whatever pollutant they're regulating. So that's the risk range, 1 in 1 million to 1 in 10,000. Well, the levels that they were, that the EPA was advising the Japanese on for its cleanup and for its allowable exposures, were well above the levels that are allowed in the U.S. And so this is really immoral, on top of not even really watching what's going on, to actually use their authority and advice to give bad advice to our neighbors, our friends, our upstream allies here. So where is the radiation now? It is spreading. Inevitably, it's spreading. We don't have, I do not believe, but I'm happy to learn of any really good way of knowing how much it's moving where, how quickly. According to Woods Hole, their estimates are that the radioactivity, in fact, there was an article today that the radioactivity has now, the Fukushima plumes in the water have reached Canada, and that they will peak in 2016. And what does that really mean is obviously we're being told that this is an acceptable level, or it's not high enough, or it's not above somebody's level, but we all know that there's no safe level, and this is just the beginning. And whatever's in water bioaccumulates and is much higher in the milk and the fish and the animals and in the vegetables even that we eat. So it's certainly of concern. We are like frogs in hot water. Well, the people in Japan were actually directly getting burned. The rest of us downstream, downwind, the radioactive environment could very well be getting higher and higher. In fact, there's really no way that it can't if we have more and more radioactivity being released. Let me see what my time is here. Do I have, like, two more minutes or something, Tim? Anybody watching that?
Yeah, go ahead, Dee.
Okay. So the action levels in the U.S., or the action steps that we are calling for in the U.S., are to prevent the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, from further weakening our radiation protections. And there is a comment period until June 4th, the EPA webinar on their proposed rule change at 40 CFR 190, which will update, as they say, the allowable radioactivity protection levels that EPA has. There's also a petition by the Fukushima Fallout Awareness Network, a group of organizations in U.S. and Japan, calling for reducing the allowable cesium contamination in food in the U.S. In Japan, 100 becquerels per kilogram is allowed. The U.S. guidance is 1,200 becquerels per kilogram. And so we have petitions in the U.S., and there's also a similar one in Germany calling for limiting it to 5 becquerels per kilogram and calling for monitoring of food. There's a petition that's a campaign that's starting out of the Tennessee Valley around the TVA nuclear reactors, Mothers Against Tennessee River Radiation, called Make Radiation Visible, calling for having some kind of a dye or coloration accompany any radioactive releases so that people within maybe 5 or 10 miles at least have a way of observing that it's radioactivity, that radioactivity is in the air. At this point, we really don't have a way of knowing, and so this is an experiment that is being proposed by a growing number of people. And it would also call for real-time monitoring around nuclear facilities and public reporting around nuclear reactors and other nuclear facilities. Let's see, there's also in the U.S., well, I wanted to say we want to support the Japanese efforts to continue evacuating people from areas that are contaminating, and now we have the concern with people being pushed back into those areas. We still are concerned and oppose the burning of radioactive rubble throughout Japan that has been happening now for over a year, and support and demand food monitoring and stricter limits in Japan. So as I said, we have a growing list of websites that do have monitoring information for people who are interested in that. Simply Info, Safecast, Green Action Japan, Fairwinds, FAN, RadNet is one that it's difficult, but it's there. Berkeley, TMI Alert, quite a few on our website. And so I will halt there, and I guess we can take questions, right?
Yeah, well, thanks so much, Dan, and thanks also, Eileen and Arnie. These have been, you know, really informative and terrific presentations, kind of giving a full spectrum, you know, perspective on you know, the outcome of the accidents and what's still going on. Want to kick off the Q&A with a question, really, to all three panelists. You know, all of us here who are attending this presentation are concerned. We know others throughout the country are concerned. What should we be pushing for in terms of action on these problems? And what institutions should we be pressuring? And what is the most effective evidence we can use to show that this problem should be taken more seriously? And I think, you know, as a way to kind of, you know, start, you know, since this is a question to all three of you, really, to get your thoughts on this, might start with Eileen, in terms of also what's the best thing grassroots activists in the U.S. can do to support people working on these issues in Japan?
Well, one is the Japanese government is trying to restart nuclear power in Japan without really having even assessed the Fukushima Daiichi accident. And so if there's a lot of demand from the outside that is just completely irresponsible, that would be very helpful. For example, the issue about the radioactive discharges in the Pacific, I mean, the fact that internationally concern was raised has made a difference. It's made a difference in the media reporting it in Japan more. We haven't gotten to the point where it's pressured the government authorities enough, but they are aware that this looks very bad internationally. And so that really helps to have protests from abroad about rushing to restart nuclear power in Japan, especially because the Japanese government is trying to underestimate earthquake, how much the plants would shake in the event of earthquake. I mean, yet again, this underestimation is being made right now. We're trying to fight that. It would really help to have people from abroad do it with us.
And through what venues can people most effectively have their voices heard on that? Is there an audience at the UN, or is there, you know, more active petitions going around?
Yeah, I guess active petitions going around, but then you know, getting it into the U.S. media, because then that will help us get it into Japanese media. Mm-hmm. Also, taking it to the Japanese embassy, or writing into the Japanese embassy, and then blogging and saying that you did that. I think a protest, you know, at the Japanese embassy, of course, only then people in Washington D.C. can do it. But there are consulates around too.
We have 17. We have 17 embassies or consulates of Japan in the U.S., and the plan is on March 11th if not all of those, as many as possible, to have protests and delivery of letters calling for support for the people of Japan. And the letter that's open now, if people on this call wanted to just email in and sign on to it, we will be delivering it to the embassy in D.C., on Tuesday, and it has 6 calls as to not restart reactors, to stop the incineration of radioactive rubble, to compensate the victims of people who provide full medical treatment, to not export nuclear to other countries, to stop the flow of radioactivity into the Pacific Ocean, and to expedite the stabilization of the Fukushima reactors and irradiated fuel pools. So those are the main things that we're calling for, and if people wanted to sign on to that, that's pretty much the whole body of it, and we will be delivering that.
That's great. That's great. And we'll make sure that gets into the Japanese media. And I think, you know, people demanding that the Japanese government should protect Japanese children that have been affected by the Fukushima disaster is really important. And all the issues you just mentioned, that's wonderful that you're doing that.
Yes, so,
this is Arnie here. Let me touch on that issue of the Japanese children, and especially the young girls. And my hat's off to Mary Olson for enlightening me on this years ago. But, you know, it's already been spoken that two rem is an allowable exposure limit for the people in the prefecture. Let me put that in perspective. A kid is 10 times more radio sensitive than an adult, and a young girl is 10 to 20 times more radio sensitive than an adult. So by moving these young populations back into that community, in a group of 25 kids in a kindergarten class, if they're exposed to that 2 REM number, then by the time they're adults, one of them will have developed a cancer. So what you're saying is, out of every 25 kids in a classroom that go back into that prefecture, one of them is going to develop a cancer at the rates that the Japanese government allows. And that's unconscionable. So, you know, if we care about the children, we really need to push on that. I think we can exert some leverage through our Congress. Certainly, Senator Wyden in Oregon and Senator Boxer in California, you know, first off, they are on the Pacific Ocean, so they butt right up against the contamination. But if the diet in Japan is going to listen to anyone, it's going to listen to the American Congress. So if we can get Wyden and Boxer and perhaps Markey and Sanders and others to lobby the Japanese government to get rid of Tokyo Electric and replace it with an American contractor, there's several out there. That would be the beginning of a change in the direction on the site. So my two issues are the children and their exposure is being totally ignored, and the broader issue of replacing TEPCO by pressuring our congressmen, our senators, especially the West Coast senators, to push the Japanese government off the dime and get TEPCO removed.
And I'd like to add to that, and that is to not repeat the mistakes made after Chernobyl. In other words, we have to learn from Fukushima internationally. And so the Japanese demand that the Japanese government open up the issue to international research and international critique about the Fukushima site itself, also the health studies that are being conducted, and the environmental studies around the region, you know, in area that's contaminated, in areas that are contaminated, what happens to that environment. And Japan, the government is tremendously closed. They want to keep this a domestic issue, and it will help to have voices like voices from the Congress, U.S., saying that that should not be the way. It should be international.
Great, thanks. Well, that actually sort of dovetails with one of the other questions that's been submitted, which has to do with both, you know, the issue of transparency, but also, you know, the sort of the clampdown on, you know, on transparency in Japan. Eileen, can you speak to sort of, you know, what impact or consequences the Japanese Secrecy Act is having on reporting and getting out info on Fukushima and the, you know, its nuclear contamination and the political and health repercussions?
Well, okay. There are various concerns with the Secrecy Act. One is that the whole reason this disaster happened is because there wasn't information disclosure, and because of that, only a certain percentage of people could be critical, like a certain percentage of experts or citizens that were more aware, etc. The Fukushima disaster changed that because ordinary citizens started to participate in the debate and say, hey, this is affecting our lives. This will affect our children. This could affect our communities. And so people became more vocal. But what that Secrecy Act does is make nuclear and other issues something that only people who are very political do, only people who are radical do, only people who are willing to maybe even go to jail would do. And that really censors discussion in Japan. You know, you think, I'm worried about nuclear power in my area. I'd like to go to a meeting, but who knows? Maybe somebody who's speaking at the meeting might be, you know, violate the Secrecy Act, and I was there at that meeting. And, you know, it's that environment that was around doing McCarthy, you know, in the early 50s. It creates that kind of environment. It could, more and more, and that's a big concern. And then, you know, the lack of information release, using that Secrecy Act as an excuse. I mean, like, we have plutonium here. We have fuel shipments. you know, all of that could go under the Secrecy Act. You shouldn't disclose that it's happening, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a real big problem, and what we need to do is continue to voice our civil rights, continue to say that we need information disclosure.
Is that law passed?
Yes, the law is passed, and implementation is later, but it is passed, yes.
You know, my book was in Japanese by a Japanese publisher called Shueisha, and we sold 37,000 copies in Japan. But that was in 2012, and you know, frankly, I think the book would be banned if it were to be published today because of the Secrecy Act. So I don't know how we can influence that act directly, but we clearly need to talk about it. You know, as Americans, at least, we have this thing called the First Amendment, and as distorted as it is, it's nowhere near as distorted as the Japanese have done with the Secrecy Act. We need to stand up as a nation to support our friends and colleagues in Japan who are up against an awfully tough law that makes no sense whatsoever.
One thing is that, you know, we sometimes use the Freedom of Information Act in the U.S. because you can't get information in Japan, but you can get it from the U.S. and then you import it back into Japan. And so the more you demand in the U.S. for information disclosure, the more it will help us here.
Are you able to summarize the law?
Summarize the law? You mean right now? You mean summarize
it? What does it do? Like, what, you can't do anything?
Well, that the problem is it's very vague. So people don't really know what it covers, what will be violation of the secrecy and what won't. One part of the intent of the law is that it was very vague, so then people self-censor themselves because they don't know if a certain area would be, might violate the law or not. That is the big problem with this law, that the deliberation in the Japanese Congress, the parliament, was very vague on what would be violation of secrecy. The law itself, the text, is very vague.
Great, thanks for that, Eileen. So moving on to a question that's directed to Arnie, but I think, you know, probably all of our presenters could have something to say about this. It's a question from somebody in the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area. While TEPCO has recently acknowledged that their data gathering on radiation contamination from Fukushima over the last 3 years is inaccurate, what, Arnie, can you or the other panelists tell us about the news reports that have stated that 300 tons of contaminated water per day are being leaked into the ocean? How accurate is that number, and can we estimate the contamination to the Pacific at all anymore?
It's interesting. I find it really exciting that this call came from Harrisburg, the site of the Three Mile Island accident. You know, every accident we've had has had its radiation monitors fail. At Three Mile Island, all of the radiation monitors failed because no one expected an accident of that magnitude, and the detectors burned out because they weren't designed to handle high-level radiation. At Chernobyl and at Fukushima, they ran on electricity, and then when the electricity stopped, the radiation monitors stopped. So I think a lesson for all these nuclear accidents is that all of these releases are guesses. We know that Chernobyl and Fukushima are somewhat worse than TMI, but TMI was serious and was downplayed by our government. So every number you hear is an estimate, and at best, and frankly, is a guess quite frequently. As Eileen said earlier, the nuclear plant at Fukushima always leaked 400 tons of water a day. Now, it was clean water before the accident, but that number is pretty well known. They had pumps in the basement, like the sump pump in your house, that pumped that water out into the ocean directly. So the 400 tons a day is a known number. The quantity of radiation in that 400 tons is a guess. It's what's in the groundwater, and Tokyo Electric is frantically drilling wells right now But, you know, my experience on these leaks is that the concentration in the well is not the worst concentration in the groundwater under the site. So if we're measuring whatever in a well, it's likely that somewhere else on site it's 100 times higher. And it's not clear to me that it's the 100 times higher stuff that's not getting into the ocean. So we know the 300 tons to 400 tons solid science on that. But what the amount of radiation in that is a guess at best and incredibly speculative.
Great. Thanks, Arnie. Eileen or Diane, do you have anything to add to that?
No.
No, that's fine. Yeah, probably there are lots of questions. So.
Sure. Arnie, kind of continuing with this kind of technical line of questions, there's a question about sort of what is meant by cold shutdown, and what does that term mean scientifically rather than politically, I guess. You know, the company, TEPCO, has declared that they had reached cold shutdown at Fukushima a long time ago when they were still dumping lots of water on the plant, so the plant was not at what, you know, we would think that, you know, the term cold shutdown means. Where do things stand right now, and what does that terminology actually indicate?
The term cold shutdown really applies when a nuclear plant can be shut down. And unfortunately, you know, Fukushima really can never be shut down. It is a term of art for an operating plant when the cooling water inside the nuclear reactor gets below boiling. The plant is declared in cold shutdown. But there is no cooling water inside the nuclear reactors of Fukushima because there are no nuclear reactors left. So the term cold shutdown was a political cover by the Japanese government, almost like you know, President Bush on the aircraft carrier, the mission is accomplished. The plant continues to generate heat, but less than a hundredth of a percent of what it had when it was operating. You know, over time, the amount of heat in the nuclear core decays away, so that even though on a foggy day you'll see the steam coming off of these nuclear reactors, the amount of heat coming off the reactors is much less than it was in the first week of the accident.
And does that indicate anything to you in terms of what the sort of what state the core is in, or is that just, I mean, you know, because I think we also had, you know, around New Year's, some really erroneous reports of concern about it, you know, the meltdown restarting at Fukushima.
Yeah.
What's your sense of this?
There's not enough heat in the decayed nuclear core to melt into the earth any further than it already is at this point. You know, that's the good news. But the bad news is all of those radioactive isotopes like cesium and strontium are in enormous concentrations and are in direct contact with water, so that we've essentially taken the nuclear core and dispersed it into the groundwater. You know those, at Christmas they have those little balls that you shake up and the little things look like snowflakes falling over villages or whatever. Well, what happened in the nuclear core is very similar. There's fine particles that got spread out in that water and have moved into the surrounding structures. We know that because as you look down through the water, as you run a radiation detector down, the deeper you go in the water, the higher the radiation becomes, which means that at the bottom, out at the on the floor, is a coating of the nuclear fuel. Is it a meltdown risk? No more. Is it a fire risk? I still believe on Unit 4 there's a slim chance of a fire. Is there a chance that as we pull rods in one of these reactors in an attempt to empty the fuel pool, it can begin a chain reaction again? Yes. So all of those are concerns. But the big concern about the core melting, there's pretty much not enough decay heat for that nuclear fuel to melt any further than it already has.
Okay, great. Thanks, Arnie. So this is a question directed to Diane. I heard on the news that they are expecting cesium to be in the Pacific waters soon. I would like to know if it is safe to fish and crab from California or the Pacific Northwest.
Well, the problem is that there's not a safe level. So you pretty much have to make your own determination of risk because we don't have the information. I don't think that we've got... There's not a level that is safe, and so I guess the question is how much is really arriving, and that's the information that we don't have, is how much is there. So it's a double question there of what one would consider safe themselves. And so unfortunately, I can't really make that answer, that decision. I don't know if others here might have a better way to approach it.
May I speak to that?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think we don't have the answers. What I would like to tell people is if there's anybody out there that's worried about that, be worried at least the same amount about the nuclear power plants in the U.S. I mean, you really have a time bomb there. And I remember vividly Arnie coming to Japan and talking with the experts. Remember Arnie and I helped translate? And after
yep.
we heard about how terrible the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is, how, you know, there's so many safety concerns in the U.S. At the end of that conversation, we all said, and we're worried enough about these nuclear restarts in Japan, we all said, oh, my gosh, the next accident is going to be in the U.S. And it was, you know, a very real concern. I mean, it wasn't just a remark. It's very real. And you've got lots of tools in the U.S. For example, right now, nuclear power accident evacuation is a big issue here. For example, the city of Kobe, which is over 60 miles away from this area in central Japan, who has a lot of nuclear power plants, he stated a few days ago that the plume will arrive in Kobe, that's over 60 miles, within 2 hours after if there were an accident in Fukui, where the plants are concentrated. You know, if we look around and draw a 60-mile around all the nuclear power plants in the U.S., and you see how many people live there, well, if you live in that area, then work on stopping your plant and work on that disaster plan and how inadequate it is. We've imported the victory that people had in Shoreham in New York in the 80s, how the local people took that evacuation plan and said, can it be implemented? No, it can't. And actually stopped the plant from commercially operating. We use that experience every day here now in Japan. And it would help tremendously in the U.S. because your approval for operating a plant is dependent on the evacuation plan being properly in place. Our situation here is the head of the Nuclear Regulation Authority keeps repeating that the Nuclear Evacuation Disaster Plan and restart of nuclear power are two separate issues because legally they are two separate issues. But you, in your case, it's not. And, you know, that's one tool you can use. And it would help tremendously if we know that that's going on in the U.S. Then we can talk about it in Japan.
Sure. Well, that's, you know, and to take off on that point, Eileen, one of the consequences of the success of using that tactic, you know, in the U.S. with the Shoreham plant back in the 80s was that the U.S. NRC actually, ended up changing its rules so that it doesn't actually require, you know, a workable plan to be in place at a reactor in the U.S. And
oh,
so,
really?
Yes, and it's actually been one of the real problems in shutting down the Indian Point reactors near New York City, which is that the state actually hired a consultant to evaluate the evacuation plans, and based on that, the state and the local communities have refused to certify the evacuation plans for Indian Point. But the NRC's response is that, well, we have a plan in place that the utility company has prepared, and we believe that if there's an accident, you'll go ahead and use that plan anyway.
I see. Well, then you're in the same situation as us, and then people should be demanding that, look, it doesn't protect our safety, so we will be affected. And if we're affected, we should have a voice in what happens to Indian Point.
And NIRS does have right now
a petition into the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and a campaign to require better evacuation planning because of the experience we saw at Fukushima and Chernobyl that a 10-mile radius is not the only area that's going to be affected by this.
Right. I mean, Indian Point, you know, when I think 38 miles, it's exactly the same areas where I am at, where the Kyoto City is saying, you know, we might need to take potassium iodine pills. We will have to be indoors if an accident happened. We may have to be evacuated. And in Fukushima, their parents at that same distance as New York City is to Indian Point that are pounding the table, you know, at government offices demanding safety for their children because the children are in such a contaminated area. So, yeah.
You know, the same engineers that built the Fukushima Daiichi plants were based in Manhattan in New York, and the company that designed the reactor was based in San Jose, and I spent many, many, many weeks at both of those locations. So the same people that built the reactors that blew up in Japan built 23 more just like them here in the United States. So to think that this is a Japanese problem and there's no spillover, the same engineers worked on 23 right here in the States. Outside of those 23, we have other reactors, and I'll talk about the plants in California, the Albertanians, that are knowingly allowed to operate despite severe seismic risks. The NRC has, with a wink and a nod, ignored the seismic problems at Diablo Canyon. And then on the East Coast, we have the Oconee plants in South Carolina, and they are downstream of a huge hydroelectric dam. If the dam fails, the NRC has said the probability of 3 meltdowns, just like Fukushima, is 100%. So to think that we are somehow different here in the United States is simply just not true.
Yeah, and one thing I'd like to note, and this is from the Shoreham experience too, is if you're listening to this and you go, okay, I live more than 60 miles from a plant, well, if something happens, the people there will be evacuating to your city, will be going, you know, you'll be needing to deal with a disaster concretely, like how do you decontaminate the cars, how do you service these people. What happens to all your hospitals when everybody else has to come additionally? What happens to your schools, et cetera? So if you're that further away, don't think that you're not directly involved. Now, for example, here, Kyoto City, my city, has to accept 69,000 people from one of the cities up north near the plant. Okay, where are they going to come? You know, are they coming to our building? Are they coming to the nearby sports center? I mean, it's very real. And these are plans that are written and actual locations that are written, you know, your town, this area, this gymnasium, et cetera.
Sure. Well, as an example in the U.S., you know, for instance, there are three reactors that are on the shore of Lake Ontario, just north of Syracuse, New York. And, you know, the plants themselves, the 10-mile radius, is, you know, is in a, you know, sort of area north of the city of Syracuse called Oswego. But the evacuation plan calls for people from Oswego to be evacuated to a fairgrounds area in the city of Syracuse that is basically just, you know, 20 miles further downwind, where the contamination would likely be going. And that's that, you know, and this is still the approved plan for the evacuation, you know, and for those reactors.
Yeah, right now in Japan, right now, a lot of the cities where the evacuation, they will accept evacuation. What they're saying is that we cannot accept those evacuations if we evacuate. So these are cities around here in this area, in the Osaka, Kyoto area, they're saying that.
Okay, so moving on to the next question. Eileen, this is a question to you, kind of taking it back to Japan and actually touching on one of the issues that Arnie just raised. My question comes from the Japanese Diet report from July 2012 on the Fukushima catastrophe. It seems that the Japanese nuclear power industry has been pressuring for anti-tsunami seawalls to be lowered in order to save themselves money. My question is this widely known in Japan, and is the Japanese nuclear power industry still trying to get away with this the second time around?
Yeah, well, one is it's sort of well known in Japan, they are trying to get away with it, and they are unfortunately being somewhat successful. But you know, tsunami walls are being built. They're insufficient, but they are being built. One of the big problems is that the Fukushima Daiichi accident, they're trying to write it off as only having been caused by the tsunami, whereas there's evidence that the earthquake that hit, before the tsunami arrived already, there was damage to the reactor site. So the biggest underestimate that the Japanese utilities are trying to pull off and the nuclear government is trying to say yes to is underestimation of the earthquake motion of the reactor sites that have applied for restart. The tsunami issue is now being addressed more, and so the estimate on the kind of tsunami you might have if an earthquake occurs, there's one method of simulating that. If you use that same method for the same earthquake happening, but you applied it to the reactor sites and how much the site would shake, none of the nuclear power plants in Japan could operate. And yet they're using another method to estimate it, and so that it doesn't shake that much, and the reactor sites can pass the inspection, the approval for their application could be approved. And that's what we're fighting. We're saying that you should use the same model, but the Japanese government looks like they're going to allow the model that only is modeled after earthquakes, non-Japanese earthquakes, basically. And we're saying you have to model it on what's happened in the past in Japan. Got anyway, this is the fight we're having, and we meet with the government, and it's Ustreamed, and it's in Japanese. You know, it's broadcast, but it's all in Japanese, and, it's hard for the rest of the world to know this battle that's going on in Japan now.
Yeah, maybe we need a translation service for those meetings to get the news out to America.
Exactly. I mean, if you could support all of us here with the translation service, that would really help. But that's, I think
we'll put it on the list
on your plans and work on criticizing the Japanese government, going to the embassies, etc.
Great. So, and this is a question for Arnie. It's it sounds like it's sort of an engineering question, but I mean, maybe Eileen, you can comment on it as well. Is it possible to build a thick cement wall and floor under the reactors and most of the way up to prevent further leakage pouring into the oceans? As the necessary safeguards and shutdown processes are taken, is it possible to essentially encapsulate the radioactivity like it was with the sarcophagus for Chernobyl?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I guess I really don't know. I mean, I guess you could inject concrete into the ground and inject enough concrete into the ground that over time you'd essentially seal the plant from the ground. You know, when the accident started, there were several of us. I wasn't the only one, but it was in my book, so it happened in the first year anyway. What I said is, the problem is not preventing the water from leaking out. The problem is to prevent the clean water from leaking in. Mm-hmm. And what the Japanese have done is, like, you have a spigot on in your tub, and the water level is getting higher and higher. What the Japanese have done is made the sides of the tub higher. But what I'm proposing is the real key is to turn the water off. And that can be done. I mean, hydraulic engineers, geological engineers, have said that the trick would be to go up into the mountains that are on the land side of the plant and divert that groundwater so it doesn't enter the plant. At that point, you can make some progress. But I imagine you could essentially hydraulically grout the entire plant and over time make a, if not impermeable barrier, a semi-impermeable barrier that would make some progress on that question. That's a good, thoughtful question. Thanks.
Yeah, and just to quickly add to that, the reason the international community that's not just the nuclear industry get involved is important is that, for example, that what just Arnie just said, it has to be assessed, and it has to be assessed not by vested interest who wants some money on a big contract, because then you won't get the best plan. What you need are experts to assess really what should be done and then create a plan for doing that rather than the other way around. You know, we want to make lots of money building an ice wall, and that's what we're going to push for it. That's what those meetings are right now with the Japanese government. They're closed door, and basically they're like this big contest for contracts right now. And that has to be changed. And for that, you need an international task force on Fukushima. And you need to tell the Japanese government through the Japanese embassy and consulates that that has to be done. And then you can start having this really good discussion, like Arnie's proposing, other experts are proposing, and then maybe implement something that makes sense.
Great. Thanks, Eileen. Now, we only have a few minutes left, so I want to move on to a couple more questions. We've gotten a ton of them. This is a question regarding the fuel pools, and you know, really it's directed to Arnie and Eileen, but I think, Diane, you might have something to add to this as well. The question is, RE Unit 3 and 4 storage pools for high-level radioactive waste, Fukushima Daiichi Unit 4 as well as 3, high-level radioactive waste pools, what are the risks at Unit 4's pool? And Arnie has recently reported that the 50 tons of extraneous debris that fell back into the Unit 3 pool may mean the condition of the fuel there is even worse than the status of Unit 4. Is it, quote, alarmist to be concerned about such risks?
Well, I used to build, when I was a senior vice president in the industry, I ran a division that built nuclear fuel reactors. Four boiling water reactors.
Built what, Arnie? Like, what did you build?
That I built nuclear fuel racks for boiling water reactors exactly like this. And one of the tests, once the rack is built, is to put a dummy rod into each of the holes and pull it out and make sure that the friction isn't too high. And it's an extraordinarily hard test to do. I am sure that the distorted racks in 4, because of the earthquake and the roof falling in, and the more distorted racks in Unit 3 because of the explosion, earthquake, and the roof falling in, are going to be no longer square, which is going to mean that the nuclear fuel is very difficult to pull out. I know what's happening now in Unit 4 is that TEPCO is cherry-picking the fuel. They're going around and finding the easy ones to pull out, and then they'll go back and pull out a few more, but they're not doing it in any systematic way. Their goal is to show some progress, and hopefully everybody will forget. And then when they hit the hard fuel, people will move on. The problem is that when you pull too hard on nuclear fuel, you snap the fuel. And that releases radioactive krypton 85 gas into the atmosphere, which would be exhausted from the building and up into the atmosphere. So that's the big problem of removing fuel from damaged fuel racks. The other issue is that the racks have been so hot that the boron that's used to prevent a nuclear criticality has dissolved out of the racks. And Tokyo Electric is adding boron to the water in order to prevent what we call an inadvertent criticality, basically a nuclear reactor in the fuel pool. That's not good because a fuel pool is not designed to handle a chain reaction in the fuel pool. So there are major concerns that anybody who's ever built who's ever built nuclear fuel racks understands.
Great. And let's see. Moving on to another question that's come up. Both, I think, Diane and you, Eileen, referred to the practice of how to, you know, of disposing of some of the waste from the remediation efforts by burning rubble in incinerators. Can you talk, you know, give us more of a clear sense of exactly what's happening with that and what are the what's happening with the with the emissions from those facilities and what's being done with the other solid waste that's coming out of that process.
Eileen, do you want to go?
Okay, just briefly, and then Diane. One is that all this rubble is coming out of the Fukushima area and disaster, and it's difficult to find where to take it. And so the Japanese government has said, let's just distribute it to various places and burn it. And there's been tremendous opposition all over Japan. And this is by people that weren't political before, that weren't anti-nuclear before, but they realize that this is being brought to their communities and they want to protect their families. They are speaking up, and a lot of people have been able to stop the mayor from saying yes, but some places they haven't, and the material has been burned. I believe it's why send it all over to have this done? It's more like, let's create, you know, the government, I think, wants to create a culture of the cutoff. If it's something below a certain level, then it can be treated as industrial waste. They have created a law before Fukushima that does that, and I think that they're trying to move that forward to implementation, because now, you know, there are going to be old reactors, they are going to be decommissioned, then you will have to deal with the waste that's coming out of the whole nuclear industry, not just Fukushima. And they're trying to create the pathway that way by distributing all this stuff all over and have it burned.
Said that they want to share the, I don't know what it is.
Share the burden.
Yeah. And
sorry, what was that, Dee?
Well, the government has been saying this is a way to share the burden from Fukushima around the country. It's also to take away any kind of control group that you might have of people who are exposed and not exposed. It's another way of dispersing industry-generated radioactivity. And I would comment on Eileen's talking about these bags of waste all over the place. I saw pictures from a friend who went to Fukushima and returned and showed bags. Now, supposedly there are blue bags for the radioactive waste, but sometimes they run out of blue bags. And so as people clean up the supposedly radioactive material, they put it in blue bags, and the blue bags are piled up in schoolyards and next to the house and on the street with nowhere to go. And it's just such evidence that there's no away for radioactivity. It's either in the bag, it's going to get burned in the incinerator. There's no place for it, speaking to somewhat the converted here, but it just makes the case so clearly that there's nowhere to put this nuclear waste. Even if they were to so-called clean up Fukushima, where would it go?
The other thing is it pits people against people, because, I mean, how do you feel in Fukushima when there's such a heavy dose there, and then somewhere else they say, we don't want this, and it's a much lower dose, you know, that they're accepting. And it pits citizen against citizen, you know. And then in the meantime, the criminals, I mean, the people who actually made this whole problem happen, they're sort of, they're not in the limelight. The limelight, the media is reporting about, you know, certain citizens, the contamination in Fukushima and all the bags and having to deal with it, versus then the citizens who are opposed to incineration. And it takes the debate in a different direction, and that's really unfortunate.
Now, before the secrecy law passed, I had heard that there was a professor opposing the incineration who was put in jail.
Yeah, it's not because of the Secrecy Act, because it's not, the implementation hasn't happened.
But it was before that. It was a year ago. So even then.
About that one. I don't know about that one. But you are labeled when you're opposing this kind of thing.
So I'm aware that we've come up on 8:30, and that was when we were scheduled to end this presentation. Want to circle back to our presenters and thank all of you again for being with us tonight. Especially you, Eileen. Calling in from Japan is really terrific. But I want to give each of you an opportunity to kind of share any final thoughts about about these issues or about what the American public can be doing to help with the situation of Fukushima.
Well, I'll start with joining the campaigns that NEARS has to improve the emergency evacuation zones, to join in on our letters to the Japanese embassy. Well, we're taken to the embassy that are going to Abe, and to press the U.S. Congress on holding hearings, giving more attention to Fukushima, and to help prevent the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency from weakening even further its already inadequate radiation protection standards.
Well, the other thing, I'd like to say three things. First off, the Japanese have three things to be thankful for in the middle of the worst industrial accident in the history of the world. And the first is that the people on the site behaved honorably and are my personal heroes. They could have run, they did not, and they were able, at extraordinary risk to themselves, to stop this chain reaction from getting any worse. That's number one. Number two is the Japanese should be thankful that the tsunami happened at 2:00 in the afternoon, as opposed to 2:00 in the morning. There were 1,000 people on site in the afternoon, which allowed them to fight this beast. If the tsunami had hit at night, there would have been maybe 100, and the infrastructure had been destroyed, so people could not have come back in. And instead of 3 meltdowns, we would have had 14 meltdowns if the tsunami had happened 12 hours later. And that's not just Fukushima Daiichi, but Fukushima Daini, Anagawa, and Tokai. And the last thing is, as bad as the accident is as far as contaminating Japan, 80% of the airborne radiation went out to sea. If the wind had been blowing the other way, Tokyo would have been evacuated and Japan would have been cut in half for centuries. So we're witnessing the worst accident in history, and in fact, we're lucky that it didn't get much worse.
Well, thank you, Arnie, for that optimistic thought. Eileen, do you want to take us out here?
Okay, leaving with that thought that Arnie just said, the next time we may not be that lucky, and some disaster could hit when there aren't that many people at the reactor. Also, the wind can be blowing in the direction of the huge amount of population. So I think to have the international community, I mean, the U.S. public be aware and speak up, saying that the Japanese government has no right to push restart forward in a country that is so earthquake-prone. Without the safety assured that another disaster will not happen in Japan. I mean, we're shaking all the time. I was at Tokaimura yesterday, the ground was shook yesterday. I was sitting there, and there was an earthquake. I mean, we're living in an earthquake-prone land. That's where it's a big nuclear complex in Japan, the oldest, biggest. So really have the international community be vocal about that. If you're living in the U.S., look at your evacuation plan. See where the evacuees go and activate the community in that zone, the area where the evacuees go to. That will help be a big tool in helping stop nuclear power in the U.S. I mean, if you have an accident there, it's going to affect all the rest of us and the rest of the world, too. And then finally, this letter that NEARS is is circulating to take to the Japanese embassy and consulates. You can find that on the nearest site. Is that correct? If you go to the nearest site? Yeah, okay. Well, please, please sign on to that, and we will advertise that in Japan. And thank you.
Great. Thank you, Eileen. And thank you to everybody who attended tonight. This has been, for us, you know, a really great experience. You know, we're past 8:30, and this looks like there's still, you know, over 60 people on the line. And so, you know, we hope you'll stay tuned for our next briefing in a few months. And we hope that you'll also, you know, get engaged, and as everybody has encouraged tonight. And we hope that you'll, you know, sort of stay in touch with NEARS, support our actions, and support the organization. We're there for you, so please give us a call anytime if you have questions about what's going on at Fukushima or at your local nuke, and we will put you in touch with the right information and the right resources. So, again, thanks, everybody, and, you know, and have a good night.